Thank you, Erica, and again, welcome everybody. Glad you could make it today. Hoping to teach you a little bit today about some things that you can do to help secure your application as it's in the cloud or as you're moving it to the cloud. And I wanted to kind of start with just a brief summary of some of the things that have happened lately. And it was funny because when I went to put this list together, I originally thought that I was going to have to take a list from the last 6 months or the last year. And you'll notice as these events appear on the screen that they're all from the last couple of weeks. So it's pretty interesting, you know, how frequently, and this is by no means a comprehensive list of security breaches that have occurred in the last, since the beginning of this year. I picked this particular set because they're kind of broadly representative. So the Zaxby's breach was due to a malware problem. So one of the ways that people can have security issues, the Utah Health Department was one of those cases where there was a USB drive that went to walkabout. So there was data on a little piece that was really not properly controlled and not properly secured, so something to think about. The Cumberland one is one of those cases where the website itself was subject to unauthorized uploads and someone put private personal data of people onto a website for the public to see. So a access breach, but not a typical let me steal data, but let me use you to publish data. The Florida one was a mobile device stolen containing a bunch of data. And the good old FBI NSA, NASA one was a classic SQL injection, one of my favorites. So there's all kinds of different things that can happen to you. And you really have to be aware of exactly where, what, when, and take a very holistic approach. So we're going to really approach the software side of it today and not really talk so much about your network security and things like that, your physical security. But I wanted to make sure I pointed out that even if you secure your application, that you're still subject to, you know, a mobile phone with data on it disappearing, and you should take steps against that. But if you're not yet pushing your stuff into the cloud or you're beginning to do it, one of the things is to think about the attack surfaces. What are the ways that people can attack me? And in the traditional application, I had a UI, and inside there I was talking to a database in some, maybe a standard way, maybe in a proprietary way, but the UI wasn't designed to execute arbitrary code and therefore wouldn't accept data packets coming in and wouldn't accept alteration of the UI based on the data coming in, etc. So there was relatively few attack surfaces. It might be that you could attack the database directly or the legacy system directly, irrespective of the UI, but the UI, to use it as a tool to manipulate some system, would have been pretty difficult. Now, suddenly in the cloud, here's a typical kind of setup that people have. There's things going on. You have some servers, you have some partners, you've got access through the internet, you've got CRM applications, pieces moving in the cloud, out of the cloud, around the cloud, from app to app. And if you look at the attack surfaces here, everywhere where there's an entry point, a person could go after the system. And so there's a lot of different places. And in many cases, if you're using, for example, a third-party credit card authorization service, your data is moving in and out of your control and in and out of your access area. So there's issues of trust. Do I trust them, first of all, and then do I trust the data that they send me to make sure that there's no man in the middle? How can I be sure that the packets are coming from where I think they're coming from, etc.? So there's a lot of issues like that that suddenly become important, and you really have to take a much stronger approach. Again, if I have a CRM application inside the office, and all people can do is show as many records at a time as my thick client will let them, it's not such a big deal, whereas if suddenly my database is exposed to the public, it's potentially a huge deal. So let me just kind of peel this thing apart. What you really need to do is take a comprehensive solution, and I'm not going to drill too deep on this particular slide at the moment, but I wanted to impress upon you the idea that you really have to look at every aspect, from policy management, project management, from the IT side, from the development side, using a variety of techniques, automated analysis, peer code review, unit testing, etc. We'll talk about a bunch of these particular techniques in brief and what they do well and what they leave you wanting for, not with the idea that you should reject the technique, but understand that if you want to really be secure, you need a blend of multiple techniques working at different levels to really make sure that you're going to be secure. So, you know, a typical application, you have it, you stand it up, you have a problem, you start testing for security, right? And that test might be a pen test, it might be a, you know, quote-unquote monkey test, where we sit down and try and pound the thing. It might be a white hat who you hire somebody to come and poke at your application. It might be a more modern set of flow analysis, more of a white box view. But you look and you try and find something. When you find the vulnerabilities, then you isolate them and you try and figure out, okay, how can I make this go away? Now, ideally, when you make it go away, you don't want to just say, hey, go fix the vulnerabilities you found. We had, you know, 17 places where someone could get unauthenticated access to the system. Instead, you want to say, thou shalt not let unauthorized access occur. And then beyond that simple edict, which isn't really enforceable or measurable, you want to craft a more detailed policy that really says, we want to write our code in such a way so that this thing can't happen. So, classic one, people say, don't send data that's in plain text, especially passwords in plain text, right? This was the big thing with Facebook last year, where you could go to your local Starbucks, sit with a simple application that people had in an app store, and pull people's Facebook passwords out of the internet around you because they were sending plain text traffic. Now, on one hand, you could try and code review all the code and look for particular instances of plain text traffic. On the other hand, you could implement a very strong policy that said any use of HTTP versus HTTPS is a failure in our organization and a flaw and must be fixed. And if you really have control of your holistic system, you could actually block HTTP at the router. So not only have you got a way to easily detect it in the code, you've got a physical ops protection against that kind of traffic. And so that's the kind of policy you want to craft, is not just the let's go fix it early, that early detection, which is nice, but really that preventative strategy. Fix the things that you then find, right, now that you're looking for root causes. Fix the weaknesses, right, not just the bugs. Put tests in place to make sure these things never happen again, and do it over and over. So that's why I wanted to talk about policy management. And it's funny because somehow when we do security, policy either doesn't occur or it occurs at a very abstract, disconnected level. Policy, as I just described, needs to be very real, very actionable, very measurable. So it can't just be thou shalt have a secure application. It needs to be, passwords have to be at least 12 characters, and they need to have at least numbers and letters and one special character and at least an uppercase letter in them and things like that. And then you need to put in place measurements to make sure that these things are happening. And you need to keep them in a place that people can look at them, that they can be used during code review, that they can be used in automated analysis, etc. This helps you get very predictable results. The reason people sometimes avoid this step is that it takes some upfront time, right? It's a very front-loaded activity, but it really, really pays off. Static analysis, it's another thing, right? And people use, for example, the flow analysis form of static analysis to find security bugs. And this is a great low-hanging fruit method. It doesn't really cost a lot. Yes, you pay for the tool, but it, you know, it's a one-time upfront cost or an annual cost. And essentially, then the tool works for free, so it's a lot cheaper than a developer trying to find problems, and it'll find problems very consistently. This is a great form of early detection, and if you actually expand your static analysis beyond just the flow analysis to a traditional pattern-based static analysis, you can actually craft policies that will do prevention rather than just early detection, and we'll talk more about that in just a moment. Peer code review. Code review is a great way to find potential security problems. I did a survey a while back with developers to find out what they thought problems were with security. And training is really the constant, one of the very top issues, that not all programmers are aware of all the bad things that can happen to you. And I really think of a security professional as being a person who's, you know, one part ops, one part DBA, one part network administrator, one part hacker, one part, you know, Unix admin, one part programmer, etc. And so to really understand how you can be attacked, you have to understand a whole lot of different things. And that peer code review, what it does is it puts different kinds of brain power at your disposal to look at what you're doing. So it's a very powerful thing. Now, the neat thing about using peer code review in conjunction with things like static analysis or unit test, etc., is that your peer code review is now not concentrating on your coding policy. It's concentrating on your design, on your security, understanding that this is the right way, the best way, etc. So that's really the power of it. Now, the drawback is that, you know, people talk about it, don't necessarily perform it all the time. And what you really want are tools that will allow you to perform code review where necessary, outside of getting everybody in a room, so that it can be done on people's time schedules and not interrupt, etc. So having tools that help supplement your peer code review policy can really help. And if you're geographically distributed, they're even critical. Unit testing. This is great because what you do is you create little tiny tests. Hopefully you're writing really tiny, you know, components that are very cleanly defined, have clear boundaries, and you can write little unit tests that make sure things are working properly. And this will move the validation and the testing much earlier and allow you, when necessary, to recraft the code. Because what happens with security violations is that sometimes we find that we can sort of hack together an answer and say, oops, I forgot to put a check there, right? And that's simple enough to fix. Other times we look at the code and go, wow, that was really not written the right way to be secure. I thought I was building Fort Knox and I built a house. And suddenly I put bars on the windows, but the doors are weak. I've got to start all over. And so the earlier that you can find out that your design isn't as secure as you want, the better. So unit testing can really help do that. The drawback is that unit tests that aren't well designed end up being noisy. The old physics phrase, entropy increases. Your unit tests will get noisier and noisier. The best sort of unit testing is done in conjunction with this peer code review, where you decide what you're going to test and other people look at it and say, wow, that's really the right test. And by the right test, I mean that the test, when it passes, that it's meaningful. You know that the thing is working. And when the test fails, it's also meaningful. So you know that if it fails, you know what it is that's failing. So if you have giant tests that are testing 17 things at once, it's nice at an integration level, but at a unit level, it tells me nothing when it fails. So having a peer review against the unit test is a way to keep that that noise and evolution problem in check. Continuous regression testing. This is one of those things, right? Take the unit tests, take the integration tests, automate them, run them constantly against the trunk or the build tree or whatever you have, whatever you can, and start looking for problems. Again, the tests need to be good tests. They need to be able to be kept clean. And the neat thing is that now when you have problems, you don't see old problems creep back in. You're not looking at degradation. And it's funny because if you start looking at, and go type security breach into your favorite search engine and click on a bunch of these problems that you see and see how many of them were applications that used to be secure and then ceased to be secure. So it really helps from a stability area. And again, that big drawback is the noise that it increases. So, you know, making sure that you review tests and that you, this will sound strange, but that you're willing to give up tests that are noisy. It's really tough when you've crafted a test to say, oh, you know what, I shouldn't run this anymore. It's just, you know, it fails too frequently. Rule of thumb, if the test fails more than half the time with a false positive, dump it out. There's probably a much better number for you. Maybe it's lower, maybe it's higher. But find somewhere and draw a line in the sand and don't keep tests that are noisy so that you will run them more often. If you only run your integration and unit test suite right before you release, again, you're going to end up having to either allow a bunch of weaknesses into the system, hoping they won't be found, or delay your release or hack fixes into it rather than fix things properly. pen testing. Pen testing is a great way to test things. And again, pen testing, automate pieces of it that you can, grab white hats, either hire people or grab the security-minded individuals, the hacker-minded individuals in your organization, and have them try to penetrate your own application, best people from other teams, so that they really, you know, take a proper view of the thing, and see what you can do. This is great because it really is a validation of whether you've done a good job or not. Now, the funny thing is that most people, when they do their pen testing, respond to it improperly. And I know that sounds crazy, but what really happens is that people do pen testing and they fix these symptoms that they find and don't understand that pen tests shouldn't find anything. If it finds anything, my process is messed up. My software policies aren't proper. So I need, when I find something in pen testing, I need to not only fix it, but I need to go, what's the root cause to this? How do I craft a software coding policy that will keep this from occurring ever again? And I need to take the view that anything found in pen testing is not only to be fixed, but a policy is to be crafted to prevent it. Also understand that pen testing is in no way thorough. It cannot be thorough because of the nature of cloud-based applications. And so, again, it's great as a smoke test to tell me if I've done a good job, but if it passes fully, it doesn't mean that I'm fully secure. So it's just one tool in my arsenal. So let's look at a classic sort of application, right? I have a bunch of different inputs. There's a bunch of paths through the application that eventually end up as some form of SQL statement that talk to some form of data system. I have three different entry points here. I've got 9 potential paths through the code. Now, obviously, 3 entry points is an unbelievably simplistic application. And already, I have 3 squared potential paths through my code. So if I'm doing something like flow analysis or pen test, can I really hope to catch every possible path? And the answer is no. So something really simple, such as validating input to detect it, can be problematic and kind of iffy. If I look at the vulnerabilities, I have these 4 different places where bad code actually will do harm to me. The solution is to validate your inputs upon entry. So in other words, take your piece of code, wrap it in a function that does the validation so that there's no paths between input and validation. I can easily check this in software, and any input not wrapped in validation I can flag. So that's a really good approach because input validation, as it turns out, prevents so many attacks. If you look at like the OWASP top 10, the CWE top 25, there's a lot of things, and some of them are even at network layer, etc. But the most common application vulnerabilities have to do with input, and they all have fancy different names, like cross-site scripting, or SQL injection, or miscellaneous file execution, etc. But they really have to do with a single root cause, which is the fact that you got input and you blindly used it, trusting that it was not going to do anything harmful. So input validation is really the low-hanging fruit that you can do to really clean things up. So I can't really overstress it, because when I see things like last year's big Sony breach being SQL injection, or in December this FBI NASA breach being SQL injection, had you put in place a policy like this where you do validation and you have a static analysis tool that can check not just flow analysis but actually tell you that every single input method is wrapped in a validation method, and if you have a policy that says generating dynamic SQL is disallowed, we need to use stored procedures, then you could say that SQL injection, for example, is 100% preventable, as are most input validation related security attacks. Now, I know that sounds like heresy, and you may not have ever heard that, but it's easy for security professionals to fall into this pit of despair where you feel like, oh my gosh, I can just do as well as I can do. And it is true that you can never be 100% secure. Even if I do all this, there's other ways to attack me, but at least I can put this one to bed and not worry about it. And again, it's the most common thing people are doing. It's the easiest thing to do. And there's a lot of bots out there that do it for people. So I recommend, if you haven't fully secured your application, this is where you start. I also wanted to point you, before we get into our Q&A, at some really great resources that are available on the web. And there are others, but these are some of the big ones. CWE, if you're not familiar with it, it's Common Weakness Enumeration. It's a project really under the auspices of the U.S. government. And you'll find it administered by the MITRE organization for the government. And what they attempt to do is come up with a uniform way to define software weaknesses so that we know what is the weakness, what causes it, how difficult is it to fix, how difficult is it to prevent, how difficult is it to execute, how difficult it, how likely is it to occur, so that you can prioritize your security work. OWASP, you've probably heard of it, Open Web Application Security Project. Lots and lots of training there. Go to that website, you can learn, send your whole team there, make them all run through their tutorials, and you will be a lot better off tomorrow. If you're doing any kind of e-commerce or retail, do the payment card industry standards, and again, there's training there. Hack.me, this is a great thing. I recently became aware of it. It's community-based security learning. You can go there, you can stand up your own little website to try and poke at it and attack it and learn how to attack it and get other people to attack it. It's a great way to sort of crowdsource your security learning and your security testing. It looks really cool, so I would say go give it a try. SAMATE, the Software Assurance Metrics and Tool Evaluation, this is where the government looks at the state of testing tools and really helps you see what can be done, what can't be done, and there's some great training. There's conferences there several times a year. There's one coming up in February and March, so check it out. And then the government has put together a very collaborative security effort, which is called Build Security In. And what it's trying to do is move past this let's test security in mentality, let's do pen testing and flow analysis and early detection, and try to go to let's build things that are solid rather than try to test security in, which is obviously not going to work. So these are all some great resources, and these slides will be available to you within a couple of days. There'll be a recording, or you can send us email. And there's actually one other thing that I wanted to show you before we start the QA, so I'm just going to pop out of the slides for just a second. If you go to the Parasoft website, which is just parasoft.com, you'll see a little resources button here on the right, and you can actually click for particular kinds of resources, and so I can click all, and it takes me to this thing that we call, amazingly enough, Resource Center, and I can click down here and I can look for particular topics, so that if I want to look at static analysis topics, it will show me everything about static analysis. So I can look at topics, I can look at products, I can look at technologies, etc. So I can look up all the various things that I'm interested in. So if you want to know more, this is a great place to come and find white papers, recordings, case studies, etc. So with that in mind, I'd like to take any questions that we have. Erica?